Daniel chapter 9 verse 20 to chapter 10 verse 21. The 12th talk in the series on Daniel was presented by David Crabtree on July 5, 2020 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 12, Daniel chapter 10, accompanies this talk.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Reformation Fellowship, the internet version. I will be continuing in my teaching on the book of Daniel. My plan of attack for this afternoon, this evening, is to finish up chapter 9. I didn't quite finish chapter 9 last week. And then I'm planning to do all of chapter 10. If I don't get too verbose, I think I can make it through that. Where I left off last week was in Daniel 9, verse 20, I believe. So I'll read the first three verses and talk about that briefly. If you'll recall, chapter 9 is talking about a prayer that Daniel gave on behalf of the people of Israel, asking for God's mercy on them. Verse 20 of chapter 9. While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and making my request to the Lord my God for his holy hill, while I was still in prayer, Gabriel, the man I had seen in the earlier vision, came to me in swift flight about the time of the evening sacrifice. He instructed me and said to me, Daniel, I have now come to give you insight and understanding. As soon as you began to pray, an answer was given, which I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed. Therefore, consider the message and understand the vision. So Daniel's been praying, and Gabriel, an angel sent by God, comes while Daniel is still in the midst of his prayer. So this is a very prompt response on the part of God. And Gabriel says that God had responded as soon as he began to pray. So it was very, very prompt. So God was listening to the prayer that Daniel had been giving. It happened during the time of the evening sacrifice. If you remember, we read earlier that Daniel prayed, I think it was three times a day, morning, noon, and in the evening. So this would have been at the time of the evening sacrifice in the temple, if the temple had been still operating. And the sacrifice in the evening, as I understand it, was a sacrifice for Israel as a whole, for the community of Israel. That's the time that Gabriel shows up. And Gabriel came to give Daniel greater insight and understanding. And he's coming to Daniel because Daniel is highly esteemed. So here's the response that Gabriel brings, verses 24 to 27. 70 sevens are decreed for your people and your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know and understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, The ruler comes. There will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. He will confirm a covenant with the many for 1 7. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on a wing, and this is of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. This is a really difficult passage, and I wish I could shed more light on it than I am going to be able to shed. I have looked at a number of commentaries on this passage. I've watched some teaching that I found on YouTube on this passage, and I come away not entirely satisfied by any of them. So I've tried to figure out how to untangle this passage, and I would say that I have been ultimately unsuccessful. Joyce Baldwin says, the last four verses present the most difficult text in the book, as commentators agree, but they most certainly do not agree as to the right way to understand the figures given. Where others have failed, it would be presumptuous to assume that one more commentator will succeed. All one can do is to continue to apply agreed criteria as consistently as possible, weigh carefully the conclusions of others, and make suggestions as to the most likely solution to a difficult problem. It's a difficult passage. It's hard to know what to do with it. As I say in my notes, it's a labyrinth of exegetical conundrums. So I'm just going to make a few observations on this passage, really. But there is one rabbit hole that I'm going to go down because I think it's a worthwhile rabbit hole. What would we expect from this response, from God's response? I think there are two things that we should expect from it. One is that it would be a meaningful response to Daniel's prayer. And secondly, with respect to the time issue that's being predicted, that it should follow the same, I would think, it would follow the same principles as the prediction of the 70 years in exile in Babylon. That is to say, God had predicted that the Jews would be put into exile in Babylon for 70 years and then return. So that is a time period, a prediction that involves a period of time. This prediction that we're looking at right now also involves a period of time. And what I am hypothesizing, what I'm assuming, is that the answer to how to untangle this prediction of time would be similar to the 70 years of exile. So I want to look at that prediction of 70 years in exile. Jeremiah predicted that Judah would be in exile in Babylon for 70 years. We've already looked at a couple of those passages. What are the dates of the exile? And you can look at that differently to say, to answer the question, when did Judah go into exile in Babylon, is a much more difficult question to answer than you would think. And that's true of lots of events, that dates of when something starts and when it ends are oftentimes far more complicated than you would think. And that's true here as well. But it seems to me that the biblical account is using as a starting date the time in which the vessels from the temple were taken off to Babylon. They seem to be a symbol of God's presence in Jerusalem. And when they go away, that is signaling God's absence from Jerusalem and from the temple. What was that date? The date was 605 when Nebuchadnezzar took the vessels to Babylon. When did they come back? Well, that's recorded in Ezra 1, 7 through 11. And they came back in the first year of Cyrus, so 539. If you do the math on that, it comes out to 66 years. There are scholars debate whether the 605 is exactly right and whether the 539 is exactly right. So there may be a couple of years there that could be different, but it's approximately 66 years. There was a reason for the 60 years, 70 years of exile. There was a reason that that particular number was given. And we find that in the Pentateuch. In Leviticus, it lists the blessings for obedience and the curses for disobedience. This is Leviticus 26, 1 through 4. And then we'll look at Leviticus 26, 32 through 35. Do not make idols or set up an image or a sacred stone for yourselves, and do not place a carved stone in your land to bow down before it. I am the Lord your God. Observe my Sabbaths and have reverence for my sanctuary. I am the Lord. If you follow my decrees and are careful to obey my commands, I will send you rain in its season, and the ground will yield its crops, and the trees of the field their fruit. So it's going through the blessings. But later it turns to the curses. So now looking at 32 to 35, I will lay waste the land so that your enemies who live there will be appalled. I will scatter you among the nations, and I will draw out my sword and pursue you. Your land will be laid waste, and your cities will lie in ruins. Then the land will enjoy its Sabbath years all the time that it lies desolate, and you are in the country of your enemies. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. All the time that it lies desolate, the land will have the rest it did not have during the Sabbaths you lived in it. Okay. So what that's saying is the curse, if you're disobedient, there will be a curse. And your enemies will lay your land waste. You'll be scattered. And then the land will enjoy its Sabbath years that you did not give it. And a Sabbath year is 7 years. Every seventh year, they're supposed to rest the land. There were 70 years in exile would stand for 70 Sabbath years. And every Sabbath year is every 7 years. So 70 times 7 is 490 years. So over a period of 490 years, Israel did not celebrate, did not practice the Sabbath year like they were supposed to do. So 490 years, do the math on that, that takes us back to 1095 BC, which would have been the time of King Saul. So that means that from the time of King Saul to the time that they were taken into exile, they never did celebrate the Sabbath years. And in 2 Chronicles, it says that that is why they were taken into exile, at least part of the reason. It says, he carried into exile to Babylon the remnant, who escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and his sons until the kingdom of Persia came to power. The land enjoyed its Sabbath rests. All the time of its desolation, it rested, until the 70 years were completed in fulfillment of the word of the Lord spoken to Jeremiah. So apparently, then, not celebrating the Sabbath years was one of the ways in which the people of Israel were disobedient. And because they did not celebrate the Sabbath years, that God decreed that the land would get its 70 years of rest for the 70 Sabbath years the people of Israel did not give the land its rest. This commandment to take a Sabbath year, to not work the land every seventh year, was a significant command from God's perspective. Here's the command as it appears in Leviticus 25, 1-7. The Lord said to Moses on Mount Sinai, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you enter the land I am going to give you, the land itself must observe a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years sow your fields, and for 6 years prune your vineyards and gather their crops. But in the seventh year, the land is to have a Sabbath of rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. Do not sow your fields or prune your vineyards. Do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the grapes of your untended vines. The land is to have a year of rest. Whatever the land yields during the Sabbath year will be food for you, for yourself, for your manservant and maidservant, and the hired worker and temporary resident who live among you, as well as for your livestock and the wild animals in your land. Whatever the land produces may be eaten." So they were supposed to not till, not prune, don't do those regular agricultural practices every seventh year, and just eat what grows up, all the volunteer plants and what grows without husbandry, and that all of the people will be fed from that. Just imagine carrying that out. What if we did that? Every seventh year, we aren't an agrarian society, but what if every seventh year, no economic activity? And we've been through the COVID thing and are going through the COVID thing. The economy was shut down for a couple of months. That's really difficult. It's really difficult to survive that kind of economic downturn. Of course, in an agrarian society, that's a little bit different, but still, it would have been an enormous act of faith on the part of the people of Israel to not work their fields for an entire year and to live off what comes up voluntarily. I think it's interesting in the context of Daniel to remember that what we talked about, Daniel is about empire. And if I'm right, empire grew out of a desire for man to take care of his own safety and security. The Tower of Babel. By not celebrating the Sabbath years, the Israelites were evidencing the same kind of distrust of God. That it was too risky to not work the fields and to just trust that God would bring along enough volunteer plants, enough produce for them to subsist on for the entire year. And so it was for that distrust of God, at least in part, that they were taken into exile into Babylon. Okay, so that was the rabbit hole. Now, what can we learn from that prediction that the people of Judah would be taken into exile in Babylon for 70 years? One thing is the number was literal. It wasn't a symbolic number, that they were taken into exile in Babylon for about 70 years. So it was literal, but it was apparently approximate. It's off by a few years. It was a few years less than the 70. So I would say it was literal, but it was approximate. Another thing that we see is the number was not arbitrary. It was not just picked out of a hat. There was a rational basis for it. And it fitted the crime. And as we just looked at, it was tied to the sabbatical years that were ignored. So God said, because you didn't celebrate 70 Sabbath years, you go into exile for 70 years. The other thing worthy of note is that the penalty involved a multiple of the number 7. There is something special about the number 7. Okay, now I'm going to go through and just make some comments on what Gabriel said to Daniel. Again, I unfortunately cannot give you a coherent interpretation of this. I have not figured that out. So I have a lot of question marks in my outline. The first part says that it apparently divides up into two groups of three things that are to happen. The first group of three things that are to happen are all dealing with sin. The second three things that are to happen deal with the establishment of a righteous order. So dealing with sin, what is being said is there'll be an end put to rebellion. There will be an end of sins, and atonement will be made for sins. Then, with respect to the establishment of a righteous order, it says that there will be established an everlasting righteousness. They will fulfill the vision and prophecy, and I assume that what that means is that the visions and prophecies that were given will all be fulfilled, and nothing will be left unfulfilled. And there will be a holy place established for God to be with his people. So those are things that have yet to happen that Gabriel is announcing to Daniel. Then it talks about the periods of time that are decreed for this to happen. And it talks about the 77s. That's literally what it has, 77s. And people assume that for the sevens, it's talking about weeks. And the word for week in Hebrew is related to the word seven. So it's assumed that it's 70 groups of 7 weeks is what it means when it says 77s. The first phase, which is the first 7 sevens, appears to be, which is, by the way, the amount of time between Jubilee years. Now we have Sabbath years, that's every 7th year. But every 7th Sabbath year is a Jubilee year, so that's every 49 years. And in the Jubilee year, there are other things that happen. It's not just a normal Sabbath year, but there are other things that happen, like debts get canceled, people get returned to their inherited, their ancestral plots of land, and there are some other things as well. So it's a special number. So the first phase will last one Jubilee year. apparently that phase is from the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the temple is rebuilt. Okay. The decree goes out, and the decree of Cyrus goes out in 539. Now, in many ways, that makes the most sense as the starting point of this seven sevens. But there are other candidates. Like I say, it's very difficult sometimes to know when something starts. So when is the decree given for the temple and the city to be rebuilt? Cyrus gives that decree, but then there are a couple of other times when that is reissued and given more support. So it's hard to know which one of those dates is the one that's intended here. And then it says until the temple is rebuilt. So apparently that's this first phase. The second phase is 62 sevens. And apparently that goes from the completion of the temple until the anointed one is cut off. And that sounds like it's talking about the Messiah. It doesn't. That there are people who don't think that this is talking about the Messiah, but I think it's talking about the Messiah, the anointed one. Messiah means the anointed one. So is this a reference to Jesus then in 30 AD? It seems to me that that's likely, but it's kind of hard to fit this in, make the numbers all work. And the third phase is 1-7. And what it appears to be saying is that a ruler will come to destroy Jerusalem. He will force many to make a covenant with him. It's not clear what that is. And halfway through the phase, he will put an end to sacrifice and offerings. And he will set up an abomination of desolation on the Temple Mount. Then he will be destroyed. Now, that's the best I can do to kind of chart out what it's talking about. But like I say, I don't know that that is that's accurate, and there are questions that I cannot answer. So I don't have a coherent interpretation of this, a comprehensive interpretation to give of this. Jack and Earl Craig and Roger Ruddle have worked out a coherent interpretation of this. And so I asked Robbie to send out some notes that Earl Craig had written up. And I've also got in the notes the link to a piece that a video that Roger Ruddle put together that basically presents the same kind of the same perspective. So if you're interested in any looking at those, that's available to you. What is this chapter about? Well, as we saw at the very beginning of the chapter, Daniel had been reading in Jeremiah. And so he's been reading in Jeremiah. He knows that the time is just about here, the time that Jeremiah had predicted for the length of time of the exile. Daniel's in his, probably in his early 80s, maybe mid 80s. He's at the end of his career, and he's looking out, he's reading his Bible, and he says, it should be happening. But it hasn't happened yet. And so Daniel knows that what God had called the people of Israel to do when they went into exile was to face the temple and pray. And so Daniel's doing the very thing that King Solomon said they should do in his speech at the dedication of the temple. So I think that's in the simplest form, that's exactly what's happening. Daniel is doing that very thing. Now, it's not clear to me whether there were other people in Babylon, other Jews in Babylon, who were repentant and who were responsive to God and turning to God at this time. I'm sure there were some. Was there a majority? I have no idea. I don't know what percentage we're working for. But Daniel knows that there is precedent for a righteous one in Israel to speak for the whole. And I think that's what Daniel is doing here. It doesn't matter whether all of the Jews in Babylon share Daniel's perspective. Daniel is speaking for them. He is asking for, he is repenting for them, and he's asking for mercy from God for all of them. Not because they're good, but for God's sake. This is something that God should do, to return them back to their land. And the response of Gabriel is that the rebelliousness of Israel will indeed be cured and will be forgiven. An eternal righteous order will be established. But getting from here to there will not be a straight line. It's not going to be an easy route. There are going to be a lot of twists and turns along the way. So even though Jerusalem will soon be restored, its travails are far from over. But in the end, God will be completely victorious. The cause of these travails, the Antichrist, will eventually be destroyed as God has decreed. Okay, so that's my take on chapter 9 as best I can do at this point in time. So let's turn now to chapter 10. Chapter 10 is the first chapter of the last three chapters, which all three chapters relate the third and last vision that comes to Daniel. And that concludes the book. This is in the third year of Cyrus. And it says that the vision was of a great war, and we'll talk about that later. It terrified him. Once again, Daniel comes away terrified from his vision. And this one was apparently particularly terrifying. This vision will go, we'll talk about it this time, chapter 10, but it extends into chapter 11. And then there's kind of a concluding chapter that still talks about the vision in chapter 12. As I've mentioned before, a curious feature of these visions in the last half of the book of Daniel is they start out highly symbolic and become less symbolic as we progress through the chapters. And this one is the least symbolic. There's a little bit of symbolism, but not much. What was happening at the time that Daniel received this third and last vision? The vision was given to Daniel in 537 BC. Now, as we mentioned before, just a couple years earlier, Cyrus had issued his decree for the Jews to go back to Jerusalem and to rebuild the city and the temple. That was in 539 BC. A group of exiles went back to Jerusalem shortly after that decree was issued. We don't know exactly how long after, but apparently shortly thereafter. So those Jews, and it's not all of the Jews, it's just a portion of them. I don't know if we know how many, but my recollection is that it's about 50,000 Jews went back at this time. And they get back to a land that they had left 70 years before. And as you can imagine, after they left, we've got this big vacuum, and surrounding peoples are likely to move in and take advantage of the farmland that's there, the houses that are there, the various things that the land has to offer. And exactly that is what occurred. So people, mostly from the north of Judah, so in the land that had been the northern kingdom of Israel, but had been mixed with other people from other parts of the Assyrian Empire who had been moved there. So it's a conglomeration of people groups. Some of them start to move south to take advantage of this open space, this empty open space that the Jews had left behind. So when this 50,000 come back, they're coming back to their land, but there are squatters all over the place. Apparently not a huge number of squatters, but there are squatters who have moved in. So this people come, this 50,000 Jews, they come back and they settle in. They try to pick up where probably their parents or grandparents had left off. Many of them go back to the land that their parents or their ancestors had owned. They try to work the very farms that their ancestors had. And it takes them a while to get their feet under them. So it is 7 months before they are in a place to rebuild the altar that was in front of the temple. Let me read from Ezra 3, 1 through 6. When the seventh month came and the Israelites had settled in their towns, the people assembled as one man in Jerusalem. Then Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his associates began to build the altar of the God of Israel to sacrifice burnt offerings on it, in accordance with what is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. Despite their fear of the peoples around them, they built the altar on its foundation and sacrificed burnt offerings on it to the Lord, both the morning and evening sacrifices. Then, in accordance with what is written, they celebrated the Feast of Tabernacles with the required number of burnt offerings prescribed for each day. After that, they presented the regular burnt offerings, the new moon sacrifices, and the sacrifices for all the appointed sacred feasts of the Lord, as well as those brought as free will offerings to the Lord. On the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, though the foundation of the Lord's temple had not yet been laid. So they're not really ready to rebuild the temple, but they want to rebuild the altar and get the sacrifices going again. So after 7 months, they are able to put together the resources to build this altar, which they build. And then they begin the regular sacrifices, beginning with a celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles. But then following that, the daily sacrifices and the new moon sacrifices, etc. Notice I put in bold, despite their fear of the peoples around them. What we'll see is they ran into considerable resistance when they began doing this. That had moved in, the squatters, didn't like what they saw happening, the reestablishment of the Jews in Jerusalem. But a little later, after they've been there for 2 years and 2 months, they are able to put together the resources to build the foundation for the temple. This is Ezra 3, 1 through 13. In the second month of the second year, after their arrival at the house of God in Jerusalem, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, Jeshua and Jozadak, and the rest of their brothers, the priests and the Levites, and all who had returned from the captivity to Jerusalem, began the work anointing Levites 20 years of age and older to supervise the building of the house of the Lord. Jeshua and his sons and brothers, and Kadmiel and his sons, descendants of Hodaviah, and the sons of Henadad and their sons and brothers, all Levites, joined together in supervising those working on the house of God. When the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests in their vestments and with trumpets, and the Levites, the son of Asaph, with cymbals, took their places to praise the Lord, as prescribed by King David of Israel. With praise and thanksgiving, they sang to the Lord. He is good, his love to Israel endures forever. And all the people gave a great shout of praise to the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the older priests and Levites and family heads who had seen the former temple wept aloud when they saw the foundation of this temple being laid, while many others shouted for joy. No one could distinguish the sound of the joys, the sound of the shouts of joy from the sound of weeping, because the people made so much noise and the sound was heard far away. So they're able to put together the resources to lay the foundations of the temple. They have a great celebration and there's lots of cheering, but in a really interesting inclusion in the narrative here, those who remember seeing the old temple, they wept loud when they saw the foundation of this temple being laid. And it's not clear why they wept, but presumably this is an inferior thing that's coming back into being. But after they lay the foundation for the temple to be rebuilt, there is significant opposition that arises against the continuation of the building of the temple. And we see that in Ezra 4, 1 through 5. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families and said, "Let us help you build, because like you, we seek your God and have been sacrificing to him since the time of Esarhaddon, the son of the king of Assyria, who brought us here." But Zerubbabel, Jeshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, "You have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us." Then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. They hired counselors to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So the people, the Samaritans, essentially, the ones from the northern kingdom, this mixture of peoples, they say, "Let us help you build the temple." And Zerubbabel and Jeshua, who are heading up this effort, they say, "Thanks, but no thanks. We will build it. We are the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and we will rebuild it." They don't want it to be contaminated, I think, by the culture and the influence that would come from those peoples in the north. But as a result, then, there is strengthened opposition to them continuing to build the temple and completing the temple. And not only do they offer resistance on the ground in Jerusalem, but they also lobby the kings of Persia to not allow this construction to continue. And that happens for a long period of time. So the construction came to a virtual halt as a result of this opposition. And at the time of this vision, Daniel would have known that the temple was not progressing anymore, that there was considerable opposition to it. And I suspect that Daniel was probably discouraged and concerned. I don't know this for a fact, but had I been a Jew living at the time and read all the prophecies, I would have thought, now that Cyrus has granted the decree that we can go back and we can build the city and the temple, this is all going to happen. From here on out, it's clear sailing because God's behind this and God's working. I wouldn't be surprised by what Daniel was thinking similarly, maybe not exactly the same, but similarly. But all of a sudden, there is stiff opposition to the rebuilding of the temple. Such stiff opposition that building comes to a halt. And Daniel has to be discouraged by this. How long will this last? It was 70 years until we go back. Now they're back, but they can't build the temple. They can't rebuild Jerusalem. And that's critical, and that's all a part of what God had said would happen. So I suspect that's the state of mind for Daniel as we launch into this vision that's given in chapter 10. First three verses of chapter 10. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a revelation was given to Daniel, who was called Belteshazzar. Its message was true, and it concerned a great war. The understanding of the message came to him in a vision. At that time, I, Daniel, mourned for 3 weeks. I ate no choice food, no meat or wine touched my lips, and I used no lotions at all until the 3 weeks were over. So it begins with an introduction in the third person. We saw that in chapter 7. An introduction just telling us when it is and what's happening. And that seems to lend a bit of gravity to the retelling of the vision. 7 was a very important vision. This one is a very important vision. And so the narrative is, the author, I think, is underscoring that. The setting for the vision, Daniel's receiving this vision, it is said within the vision that is reliable message. It is concerning a great war. Now, the word that's translated war is not the typical word for war. It's tsava. It's a bit unusual for this kind of context. So I'll come back to this at the conclusion. The author reminds us that Daniel was called Belteshazzar. And that takes us back to chapter 1. That's the only other time that he was called Belteshazzar. So it's kind of bookending the whole account of the whole book of Daniel, that Daniel starts out as Belteshazzar, and there's a sense in which he's ending as Belteshazzar. Daniel had been mourning for 3 weeks. He's fasted for that period of time, and the fast consists of eating no choice food, no meat and no wines, and also of using no lotions. He's returning to the diet that he had had in chapter 1. And as I argued in chapter 1, I think, and here in chapter 10, I think in both cases, Daniel is recognizing, he's marking, he's the feast of the Passover. But the feast of the Passover was supposed to be, it was intended to be a joyous feast, celebrating God bringing his people out of slavery in Egypt and making them his own people. What Daniel is recognizing is the circumstances now are different. The Jews are in exile. They are being punished for their sins. And so celebrating the Passover doesn't seem like the right thing to do. So he, instead of celebrating it in the way prescribed in the Torah, he is marking it in a different way. He's marking it with mourning, repentance, lamentation, and appealing to God. My suspicion is that Daniel did that every year that he was in Babylon. I don't know that for a fact, but it wouldn't surprise me by what he He marked Passover every year that same way. And apparently he was reasoning that Passover couldn't be celebrated according to the Torah until the temple was rebuilt, because the temple is a part of this whole process, and the temple symbolizes God with us. And that's what they dearly wanted. They wanted God to be right in their midst, to be intimately aware of all of their problems, all of the issues they are dealing with, and very responsive to their appeals for help. That's what they wanted. And that's clear from the Exodus account. That's what Moses wanted. After the people of Israel had built the golden calves and had worshiped them, Moses, as we read when we were going through Exodus, Moses appealed to God on three different occasions to rectify the situation. But the last thing, the thing that was that he really wanted, and he kept coming back for, is that God be in their midst. He didn't just want God to lead them. He wanted God to be right there in their midst. That's a big deal. And I think the same is true here. Daniel wants God in their midst, and therefore the temple has to be rebuilt. Okay, verses 4 through 6. On the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river, the Tigris, I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen with a belt of the finest gold around his waist. His body was like chrysolite, his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and his voice like the sound of a multitude. Okay, Daniel sees a man. And this happens, this is in the vision, and this happens on the 24th day of the month. What is the significance of the 24th day? I don't know. But it is 3.5 weeks, and the 24th day of the month is mentioned in 4 other post-exilic passages. So it would appear that the 24th day of the month takes on some kind of special significance after they are released from exile. And these prophets knew that significance and are playing on that significance. I don't know what it is. Daniel is by the river Tigris in this one. He's standing on the bank of the great river Tigris. I think this is just an observation, that it is curious that several visions that prophets receive occur while they are along rivers. We saw in Daniel 8 that Daniel was by the river in Susa. We see him by the river here. In Ezekiel 1, Ezekiel is by the river Kebar, the canal Kebar. So there's some significance to the fact that they are standing by these rivers, but I don't know what it is. A man appears to Daniel. He's called a man. He's not qualified by the word like. It doesn't say like a man, which is interesting. In most of the visions that have preceded this one, that is to Daniel, things have been described as being like one thing or another. But here it says a man, and it doesn't qualify it by like. Later on in the chapter, it will qualify it by like. So I don't know if it's significant that the like is not retained here, or whether it's just stylistic and not significant. He is dressed in essentially priestly garb. It appears to be priestly garb. Some people say it's kingly garb, but it looks to me like it's more likely priestly garb. Dressed in linen, a linen garment, which would have been white. A gold belt. It says his body looked like yellow jasper. His face is like lightning. His eyes are like blazing torches. His arms and legs are like polished bronze, and his voice sounded like a large crowd. So that's the figure that Daniel sees right off the bat. It's interesting that this man that appears is very similar to a man that appears to John, the author and the seer of a vision in Revelation, the author of the book of Revelation. Let me read the description from Revelation of what John saw. He says, I turned around, this is Revelation 1, verses 12 through 16. I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me. And when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And among the lampstands was someone like a son of man, dressed in a robe reaching down to his feet and with a golden sash around his chest. His head and his hair were like white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. His feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and out of his mouth came a sharp double-edged sword. His face was like the sun shining in all its brilliance. Okay, very similar. It's not identical, but very similar. It has almost all the same elements described and described similarly in almost the same order. So it starts out with a robe. So presumably that's linen. A golden sash, that's the same. White hair, same. Eyes blazing like fire. Up above had a face like lightning. Feet like bronze. A voice like rushing waters. Up above it was a voice like a large crowd. Then it has right hand seven, held seven stars. We don't have anything like that. And a double-edged sword came out of his mouth. We don't have anything like that. But then the face like sun shining. We had up above a face like lightning. Okay, so a couple of differences, but otherwise it's the same elements described similarly in the same order. What accounts for the similarity? This is not the only instance where we see that kind of thing in Revelation, where Revelation will include language that's very reminiscent of some image or something from the Old Testament. I'm convinced that the author of Revelation is drawing heavily on imagery from the Old Testament to paint the picture that he wants to paint. They aren't always the same images used the same way. He can take elements and combine them and put them together into different combinations to depict a different thing. Let me use just one example of that. Roger mentioned this two or three weeks ago, but there is in Revelation, there's a beast that has seven heads, but parts of each of the beasts in Daniel appear in this seven-headed beast. Let me read it from Revelation 13, 1 through 2. And I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. Okay. He had 10 horns, 7 heads, with 10 crowns on those horns. And remember, in the vision in Daniel, the horns stood for the 10 leaders of the fourth beast. But this beast resembles a leopard, has feet like those of a bear, and a mouth like that of a lion. So parts of the three beasts, the first three beasts in Daniel chapter 7. So clearly he's drawing upon the imagery that was used in Daniel chapter 7. John is drawing upon that imagery, putting it together a little bit differently. So he's combining these beasts all in one, which is very interesting and very effective, because what he's done by using this imagery, he transforms that fourth beast into something that bears a resemblance, that has features that come straight down from the other empires that had preceded it. It's a very interesting image. But it comes out of the sea, has 10 horns, it's a composite beast, so it's clearly drawing upon the imagery of Daniel 7. So what are the implications of this observation that I'm making for John's role in the composition of Revelation? The vision itself is God's composition. God gave to John the vision that he gave him. John then recorded it into the book of Revelation. But John is either recording it just like a dictation, where he's being told what to write and he writes it, and therefore God is controlling how it gets written and is retaining the imagery from the Old Testament. Or the other possibility is John is watching this vision and is understanding what the imagery is related to, how it ties into the Old Testament, and therefore is recording it in such a way that the reader can see the connection between what John has seen in his vision and the Old Testament passages from which that imagery is drawn. In other words, in this particular instance, John saw the vision that God gave him, and he sees this beast coming out of the water and the characteristics that it has. And John is saying, I know where that came from. So he records it in a way that makes clear the connection between his vision that God gave him and the Old Testament passage. If that's what's happening, and I think that's the more likely, either he's just doing dictation or he's actually a collaborator in this effort. And I've called him in my notes a savvy collaborator. That is to say, he's picking up on the imagery and then recording in such a way that it brings to mind for the reader the images from the Old Testament, the passages in the Old Testament from which the imagery comes. So in this case, John, the figure that he saw, he could have described it lots of different ways, but he describes it using the same features that Daniel had used in the same order, because he's got that idea of Daniel 10 in his mind when he's writing down this account. Okay, so the significance of that then for Daniel 10 is that in Revelation, it becomes clear that this man that he saw was essentially Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, dressed as a priest and coming with the symbols of judgment and authority. If that's true, then it is possible, it's not necessary, but it's possible that in Daniel, the figure was a man with divine characteristics, dressed as a priest. So it's the figure in Daniel appears to be man-like, but has divine characteristics. So probably a Messiah-like figure. Golden Gate says, the man in linen is not described as a holy one, but the verses illustrate the idea of the holy as suggesting fundamentally a splendor that inspires awe, rather than a purity that evokes an awareness of sin. Daniel is almost seeing God and hearing God and almost losing his life as a consequence. So this is almost God that is appearing to Daniel, if that analysis is correct. John's reaction to seeing the figure that he saw was very similar to Daniel's reaction in seeing this symbol, this figure, in his vision. And there's another similarity between Daniel and Revelation. Let me read how John responded in Revelation 1, 17 through 18. "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. Then he placed his right hand on me and said, 'Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive forever and ever. And I hold the keys of death and Hades.'" Beale, in his commentary on the book of Revelation, makes this observation. He says, "The fourfold pattern is found in Daniel 8 and 10. The prophet observes a vision, falls on his face in fear, is strengthened by a heavenly being, and then receives further revelation from that being, which is introduced by a form of the Greek word laleo, to speak. So the pattern, he sees this figure, he falls on his face in fear, then the figure touches him and strengthens him, and then he's able to receive further vision. This pattern, this fourfold pattern, as Beale calls it, is also found in Ezekiel chapters 1 through 3. It's kind of spread out. It happens over a longer stretch of narrative, but the same four things happen. Also in Isaiah 6, it's not as clear that all four elements are present, but it's a similar kind of incident. What do we make of this? What do we make of this similarity between what happens to Daniel when he sees this figure and what happened to John when he saw this figure? I think that it's significant. I think I'm calling it choreography. I think the choreography in this passage is significant. I don't know that I know the significance of that choreography, but I think the choreography itself is significant. There's this shared pattern, and it seems to be that there was this common belief in the Old Testament. We run into allusions to this a number of times in the Old Testament, that a mortal sinful man can't see God and live. But if you see God, you're going to die. In each case, these prophets see a godlike being. And as a result, they fall on their faces. And in three of those instances, the text says that there refers to them being dead or nearly dead or something like that. Then they're revitalized by that majestic being, or a representative of that majestic being. They're in a strengthened state as a result of that, and then they see the main vision, the main part of the vision. My guess as to what's going on is that the awesomeness of God is too much for mortals to bear. That in each case, that there is a sense in which it is true that for sinful mortal men to see God is fatal. The only cure for this is for God to touch them. And it takes the touch of God to revitalize them from their state of death or near death. But having seen the awesomeness of God appears to be preparation for seeing the visions to come. That is only being overcome by the awesomeness of God. That's the only thing that makes it possible for them to withstand the horror of seeing the vision that they are about to see. So that's my best guess as to what the symbolism is behind the choreography that's attached with this vision. Verses 7-9. I, Daniel, was the only one who saw the vision. The men with me did not see it, but such terror overwhelmed them that they fled and hid themselves. So I was left alone, gazing at this great vision. I had no strength left. My face turned deathly pale, and I was helpless. Then I heard him speaking, and as I listened to him, I fell into a deep sleep, my face to the ground. So Daniel was with other people, but he's the only one who saw the vision. The others all fled in fear. Daniel was completely drained by this experience and goes into his face turned deathly pale and I was helpless. And like I say, I think that means that just being in the presence of such a being is absolutely overwhelming. And it's a near-death experience that they all go through. Then he falls into a trance-like sleep. Verses 10 through 17. A hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. He said, Daniel, you who are highly esteemed, consider carefully the words I am about to speak to you and stand up, for I have now been sent to you. And when he said this to me, I stood up trembling. Then he continued, do not be afraid, Daniel. Since the first day that you set your mind to gain understanding and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to them. But the prince of the Persian kingdom resisted me 21 days. Then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me because I was detained there with the king of Persia. Now I have come to explain to you what will happen to your people in the future, for the vision concerns a time yet to come. While he was saying this to me, I bowed with my face toward the ground and was speechless. Then one who looked like a man touched my lips and opened my mouth and began to speak. And I said to the one standing before me, I am overcome with anguish because of the vision, my Lord, and I am helpless. How can I, your servant, talk with you, my Lord? My strength is gone and I can hardly breathe. So after seeing this being and falling on his face, the being reaches down and raises him up and gets him only halfway up to his hands and knees. Now, it is hard to know. It's hard to envision exactly what's happening and how many beings there are here and who these beings are. And I, again, this is something that I have yet to feel confident that I have sorted out. It talks about this man or this one like a man. Is this the same being that we already saw? Or has a change taken place? And some see a change taking place when it says, when this hand touches him, reaches down and touches him, that it's no longer the Messiah-like figure in the first of the chapter, and this is now Gabriel, because it becomes clear later that Gabriel is the one who is relating this stuff to Daniel. I'm inclined to think that Gabriel has stepped in at this point, but that may not be the case. I'm not positive. In any case, this one, whether it's the Messiah-like figure or whether it's Gabriel, says you are a treasured person, and the word there is unusual. You are a precious person. And that kind of statement from God or a representative of God is rare. He says, understand what I'm about to tell you, stand up. So he brings him up to full standing to receive the message that he's bringing. And he tells Daniel, don't be afraid. But Daniel is shaking. His knees are knocking. He's still affected by being in the presence of these divine beings. He tells Daniel that he heard Daniel's from the very first day. That God, like we saw before in chapter 9, God is very attentive to Daniel and his prayers. And because Daniel had sought to understand, because Daniel had humbled himself, God was responding. Now, what was Daniel seeking to understand? I think very specifically, what Daniel wants to understand is why it would be that God said it'd be 70 years until the exile ends and the temple and the city are rebuilt, but the temple is still not being built. So as I've alluded to previously, I think that is what is really bothering Daniel and what he would like a response to. And he's wondering, why delay the construction of the temple? And why delay God's return to live in their midst? And the vision is a response to those issues. And what it's going to say is a lot more has to happen to Israel before it is made right with God. But then it's pointed out that the delay had nothing to do with God's lack of attention to the prayers of Daniel. Something else was going on. And it talks about this I don't know what to call it, this interaction between God's representatives and the Prince of Persia. The Prince of Persia had been opposing this figure for 21 days. And Michael, and it becomes clear later in Daniel that Michael is apparently an archangel who is particularly assigned to the people of Israel. So Michael came and helped out in this conflict or whatever's going on. But after 21 days, this figure had been able to free himself and come to help Daniel know what would happen to his people in the future. So Daniel is drained. He's still emotionally exhausted, I think, from this vision, and he is encouraged by this figure. Verses 18 through 21. Again, the one who looked like a man touched me and gave me strength. Do not be afraid, O man highly esteemed, he said. Peace, be strong now, be strong. When he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, speak, my Lord, since you have given me strength. So he said, do you know why I have come to you? Soon I will return to fight against the Prince of Persia, and when I go, the Prince of Greece will come. But first I will tell you what is written in the Book of Truth. No one supports me against them except Michael, your prince. Okay, so this person, this man, and I wrote in my outline the son of Adam, and I'm not sure why I wrote that, but it'd be the son of Adam is the son of man. So this man-like figure touched Daniel again, and he was strengthened again. So it's been, Daniel was really drained of his strength, and it has taken more than one effort on the part of this being to restore Daniel. And I have great sympathy. He's over 80 years old, and I'm getting up in my years and can't imagine Daniel's situation fully. He speaks to Daniel. Daniel, again, he's highly esteemed. He says, don't be afraid. Peace, be courageous. And Daniel was strengthened by that and asked the man to speak. Then he asked Daniel, "Do you know why I was sent?" And presumably it's because he's here to tell Daniel what's going to happen to Israel, to answer his question. But he explains his delay, why he was delayed. Now, I think that what we have here is a way of describing things on earth that communicates to the people in that culture. And it's describing this, what's happening, as the forces of God fighting against Persia now and Greece later. And so I think this is what we're seeing, is the force of God against the forces of evil, in particular the force of empire. And it's using this image to show God's resistance to empire, and in particular his resistance to empire in its opposition against the things of God and the people of God. And the man is here, has appeared to Daniel to tell him what is written in the book. And I assume that the book here is the book of the history of mankind. That God has written this all out. It is, the script is done. What's happening in history is it's just being acted out, being realized. But the script is already written, and this person, I'll call him Gabriel, is going to tell him what is going to happen to the people of Israel. And I pointed out Michael, the prince of Israel, is the one who's helping Gabriel. And his job in particular is to stand up for the things of God and the people of God, Israel. Okay. In conclusion, then, I want to come back to that question left from the very beginning. What is the great conflict? And I pointed out that there is an unusual word that's used there, which I take to be a clue that we aren't talking about normal warfare. We're talking about something else. What we're going to see as the vision progresses is in chapter 11, is the conflict that develops, the warfare that develops between two Hellenistic kingdoms that were left behind after the death of Alexander the Great, in particular, the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire, and the intrigue and conflict that occurs between the two of them, both of them maneuvering to try to get supremacy over the other. This could be described in terms that fit the ancient Near Eastern worldview. I've alluded to this before, when I was talking about in chapter 7, I believe, that in the ancient Near East, they have this perspective that what happens on earth is a reflection of what happens in the heavenlies. So if King X defeats King Y, that is but a reflection of a more primary reality, and that is God X beat up God Y. So everything happening in the heavenlies, that's the primary reality. What's happening on earth is just a dim reflection of that primary reality. Well, it appears to me that what we see happening in this section of Daniel is that the vision is tapping into that understanding of the world and describing it in those terms. That is, Gabriel and Michael are fighting against the Prince of Persia and later the Prince of Greece. And that what happens there will be reflected in events among mankind on this earth. The thing that's different between the ancient Near Eastern worldview in this particular instance is not that the primary reality is someplace else. The biblical perspective is absolutely the primary reality is what's happening in the heavenlies. So that's the same. What's different is in the ancient Near Eastern perspective, there was intrigue and infighting among the gods themselves happening in heaven. And the different gods, their fortunes could vary over time. Some of you strong today might be weak in 100 years. So their fortunes varied. From the biblical perspective, God's strength doesn't vary. His supremacy doesn't change. He's supreme throughout. But what happens is God has complex purposes. And those complex purposes can work their way out in human activities in a way that resembles the worldview of the ancient Near East, where it's competing gods who are causing the ups and downs in the fates of people on earth. If I'm correct, then, the way that it's being depicted is very interesting and very helpful. Because by depicting it this way, what it's underscoring is the primary reality is what happens in heaven. And the significance of that is if it's happening in heaven, there is no question God wins. As we look at our situations on earth, it's not obvious to us that God wins. In fact, it often appears to us that some of those forces in this world are unbeatable, unstoppable, uncontrollable. They are too big and can't be controlled by anybody down here. And therefore, they are truly intimidating. I was thinking about this with respect to some of the things going on in the world today. And you can look at thousands of people, and in some instances, hundreds of thousands of people marching for this cause or another cause on the earth, here on earth. They want political change of one kind or another. And there can be so many marching that you think that is a force that cannot be withstood. And there are people marching for different causes all over the earth right now. I mean, this is a time of worldwide upheaval, it appears to me. And it looks like some of those forces at play are just too big to be controlled. And yet, what this is reassuring us is, no, where this is really being played out, where it really counts, is what's happened in the heavenlies. And in the heavenlies, there is no question as to who will emerge victorious in this. So my suspicion then is that the great conflict that's being talked about is not all this stuff that we'll read about in chapter 11, but rather it's God behind the scenes dealing with the spiritual forces of evil. And there's no question how that's going to come out. Okay, those are my chapter 10. So next week we'll go on to chapter 11 and we'll get into the heart of the vision that was given to Daniel. Thanks for your attention. See you next week.